I'm going to make a few comments about the work that I'm involved in most presently within UltraRed. I'll try to keep them short so that we can have a few questions before we break for lunch. For that reason, I'm going to take my watch off. I feel like I can't really continue right into what I was going to say without first sort of acknowledging this place, LACE. There's a lot of memories in this place, and a lot of memories of people who aren't here. One of the first benefits that the Needle Exchange had, Chan and Ming, you probably remember this, was actually here. There was an art auction here where artists donated work, and it was displayed throughout all three rooms. And people who bought the work, the money went to Clean Needles Now and to Harm Reduction Central. And those funds helped to sustain, especially the storefront. We didn't open the storefront until around 94, 95. Although the Needle Exchange had begun 2 years before as a street-based exchange. And as I mentioned before, the Needle Exchange was founded primarily by artists who were involved in ACT UP, and those who thought ACT UP was a little too much drama for them, so they went straight to Needle Exchange. And one of the sort of guiding figures with the Needle Exchange, one of the guiding figures with Needle Exchange was Renee Edgington. And I'm sure we all know these people. We all have these people in our lives, people who inspire us, people who are just brilliant, people who are so quick to connect strategy with conditions, people who always sort of change perspective on a problem and open up a whole range of possibilities that you just hadn't considered. At the same time, these people can be real pains in the ass. They can be difficult to work with. They can be people who alienate others, who are so committed and so fiercely engrossed that they can alienate and so forth. Renee was one of these people. Renee was one of these people where to be with her, to work with her, was a constant source of inspiration and a constant challenge, but you knew one day the shit would hit the fan and you wouldn't be talking together. You wouldn't be talking with each other ever again. And this is how it was with Renee. And working with her at the exchange site, she was very clear in what she wanted, right? Remember this? She wanted an exchange that was not merely direct action. She wanted an exchange that was not merely social service. She wanted an exchange that was a conceptual art practice. Everything having to do with Needle Exchange was understood as having an element of conceptualism around procedure, duration, and participation. So that the exchange box that was used for dropping the points when people would come in to get new clean points was built by her husband, who was a sculptor. The table that was the conference table was built by Kim Abeles, a local artist. The light fixtures were done by James Riva, who was a local artist. And exchange duration from this time to this time, the syringes were put in a Sharpie, labeled as that time, and when it was when an invitation came to do an installation, the installation in the gallery would be rows of hazard waste material boxes with the time and the number of syringes exchanged during that time. An invitation would come to do an installation, and she would drive the exchange Jeep into the gallery space, and that would be the installation. At every step along the way, she was inserting her everyday work and our everyday work with the exchange into the art space. And of course, the local art world at the time, you know, LA, we're talking early 90s, it wasn't as commodified then as it is now, but enough. enough to find this work not art. Right? And Renee passed away in the late 90s. She and her husband were down in South Africa. They were on a safari, and the Jeep flipped, and they were both killed. And many of the artists who were involved with Needle Exchange, they're not with us anymore, like James Riva and others. And it took me, personally, me, Don, it took me about 10 years to even talk about this stuff, because it's really difficult. So recently, feeling like I've been able to talk about it, Eddie and I and Walt and a group of us have begun to ask questions about AIDS activism today, harm reduction activism today, and how do we stop the AIDS crisis today? And of course, you begin where you left off. I began where I left off. I know it was naive, right, Walt? You begin where you left off, and where I left off was ACT UP. The AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power is a nonpartisan group of individuals united in anger to end the AIDS crisis through direct action. That's how we began every meeting, saying that, defining the group in those terms. And the united in anger part was very, very important, because it's what distinguished a radical AIDS politics from a kind of liberal humanist politics of putting a face to AIDS. Right? We know this, right? If we just got the face of AIDS out there, if we just put a face to it, then people will be transformed. And ACT UP sort of asked the question, how did we get to the point of dehumanization? How is dehumanization produced? And for those of us in ACT UP, you can only ask that question when you are mad as hell. Because then it's like, I'm not a victim. I'm not a patient. I'm not a client. I'm not a customer. I'm a person living with AIDS. And at that point, everyone in the room is a person living with AIDS. I am a person living with AIDS. We are all living with AIDS. It was essential. It was absolutely essential. And the way that you talked about, you know, questioning the question around documentation and papers, this was our way of responding to that question. We are all living with HIV and AIDS. In 1994, something fantastic happened, and that was the introduction of antiretrovirals. For many people, what was considered to be a death sentence, it became manageable. And we all know this story. We're artists, we're organizers, we're left people, whatever we want to call ourselves. We all know this. The epidemic became manageable. Of course, the antiretrovirals produce really nasty side effects, like you have to go to the bathroom every 20 minutes, and of course, some drugs make you crazy, and some will eventually destroy you because they're so toxic. But on the whole, it's a manageable illness. Into this, I thought I would return to AIDS activism. So a group of us thought we would see what would happen if we announced the beginning of a new ACT UP chapter here in Los Angeles. A new ACT UP chapter that wouldn't be about some sort of nostalgia for our AIDS activist past. An ACT UP chapter that wouldn't look at videotapes of voices on the front and go, gosh, why can't we storm the FDA again? An ACT UP chapter that wouldn't be sitting around in Plummer Park and, cruising, whomever. It would be an ACT UP chapter about today. And it became apparent very quickly that we would stumble over the words united in anger. That these were very difficult words to say. Not because they raise some sort of pain and agony and you would get choked up. I cry a lot, so I would get, But because it just seems very not, it just is not available to us at the moment. So Walt and Eddie and I and Pablo, who's not here today, we were invited by the good folks at Bienestar to come in and to meet with some support groups and to talk to support groups about where they're at. So we began asking a series of questions. Questions such as, what are the services you access in this space? What are the services you wish you accessed in this space? What are the services you access that ain't so good? And how would you describe the way you feel about those differences, about those gaps, about those lacks? As you can imagine, most of the responses had to do with frustration, confusion, sadness. And very few of the responses had to do with being angry. Now, I would say that that doesn't mean that anger isn't there. David Thorne and I have had an ongoing conversation about this subject. I think that this is not to say that people who are living with HIV and AIDS don't feel pissed off. But for some reason, when it comes to wrestling emotions into speech, the words that are available are frustration, confusion, sadness. We have heard over and over again, it's sad. So UltraRed was invited to do some performances here in the States at a number of art institutions. Fortunately for us, we can draw upon a legacy within the AIDS activist movement of dealing with art institutions. I think in some social movements, the relationship to institutions is so incredibly burdened with the history of suspicion and hostility, rightly so, that it becomes nearly impossible to engage institutions. In relationship to the AIDS activism, and in relationship to the epidemic, in relationship to the crisis, in many places in this country, it was only in art institutions that you could talk about HIV and AIDS. It was the only place you could talk to people who would identify as HIV positive. And it was the only place that it was safe to organize an AIDS activist group. Galleries, museums, and nonprofit art spaces. Now, of course, there are many reasons for this, and there's reasons that will be obvious to us. But nonetheless, there is that history. And with that history in mind, we accepted the invitation to give a performance at the Baltimore Museum of Art. It has giant stone lions out in front of it. It has echo that will last for days. You go there today and you will still hear my voice. We were invited to give a performance at the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh. We were invited by Shauna Lutger to do a performance at the Hammer Museum at UCLA. On Sunday, I go to Montreal to give a performance at a gallery at Concordia University. The week after that, Eddie and I and Robert, we go to Southern Illinois University to give a performance in the art department there. For these performances, we've assumed the model that has been developed in this group of people. And that is drawing upon the writings of Paulo Freire, where he articulates a form of participatory action research that would eventually be developed by Falls Borda and others. But initially, within Freire, there is a discussion of what popular education is and methodologically. And what it is the introduction of the objectification of an experience. That objectification of experience can take the shape of a photograph. It could take the shape of a theater piece, hence the Theater of the Oppressed. It could take the shape of a sound recording. Fortunately for me, he actually says sound recording. I'm so happy. It's in a footnote, but I'll take what I can get. So with this in mind, we have conducted these performances. Now, traditionally, as you have heard these recordings, all of these recordings that you've heard have been based on field recordings, site recordings, recordings that are taken at the actual point of contact, where people are organizing their struggles, organizing their politics, and throwing their voices as weapons against power. Or sites that are actually fraught with memory and experience. These recordings are then manipulated, altered, changed, shifted, abstracted as far as we can get, given the accountability we have with the communities of these places, and then these recordings are played back within those contexts for the purposes of reflection, collective analysis, action, making a recording, manipulating the recording, reintroducing the recording for reflection, action, and analysis and action, and on and on. In the case of these invitations to do performances around HIV and AIDS, as it so happens, I have no recordings of my time with ACT UP. Perhaps that's a good thing. I would probably have a whiny little voice. I was a skinny guy then. I didn't have any facial hair. I had a lot of hair on my head. And I was kind of strange. I was the Episcopalian who came into the group of radical fairies. So I had no recordings. We had no recordings of the past, just a bunch of voices on the front tapes and Stop the Church tapes, which, you know, they're interesting, they're fun, they serve a purpose. The Stop the Church tape is fantastic. I still think it should be required watching for every single human being on this planet. But nonetheless, what about today? So we decided that instead of making site recordings, we would conduct performances that were for the purpose of assembling a record. And to build this record, we would meet with AIDS service organizations in the towns of these museums. And this sort of field research, this militant sound investigation, would take place over the course of a week, 2 weeks, with then follow-up email. We would take whatever leads we could get, we would meet with whomever we could. Sometimes the meetings were exciting and exhilarating, and sometimes they were boring. I don't know if any of you hang out with AIDS bureaucrats, but they can be really, really, really boring. But then you would meet with young people, you would meet with folks who are recently diagnosed, you would meet with long-term AIDS activists who hadn't sort of unproblematically inserted themselves into the machine. You would meet with people, and it would just constantly be exciting. The purpose of the meeting was to hear folks' stories, to hear their histories, to get a sense from them how the AIDS machine worked, how the crisis has unfolded in that town, and then we invited them to come to the performance. At the performance, we set up a long table. Folks were systematically, procedurally invited to come and sit at the table and make their contribution to the record. Those of us in Ultra Red were very interested in what sort of affective statements and enunciations would occur as a part of those statements. To make sure that people worked at their statements, we employed a number of things that may sound a little goofy, and trust me, people snicker. We begin the performances by performing John Cage's 433. Now, John Cage's 433 is a composition that he made in 1952 as a result of seeing Robert Rauschenberg's white paintings at Black Mountain College, which were used as backdrops for a theater performance, I think by Cunningham, right? Wasn't it Cunningham? Yeah. And Cage saw these white canvases, and he was intrigued, not for the fact that the white canvases were a negation of the image, but rather that the white canvases were the visualization of possibility. And he was interested in this. Silence not as a negation, but silence as a setting or a space or an attentiveness to possibility. With this in mind, we began our performances with John Cage's 433. We actually began our workshops at Bienestar with a performance of John Cage's 433. And it was followed by a series of very simple questions. What did you hear? When was the last time you were in this space? What is the relationship between this space and the city around us? When was the last time you were here to talk about HIV and AIDS? It's very simple. And then we would hear the testimonies. First, we would hear four testimonies from people who were specifically invited to come to the performance. After each person spoke, we would manipulate and process their voice upon playback, and then the next playback, then the next playback, until we had heard all four, and then we would open up the table to other people in the audience. In Baltimore, the opening up the table to the people in the audience was merely a passing of the mic. In Los Angeles, we had four additional seats at the table, and we invited people to come and sit at the table to make comment. In Pittsburgh, we had 16 additional seats at the table, of which we filled five. We did a performance at the Banff Center in Canada, and we had no seats at the table, and we just stayed in the room until the last person left the room. Consistently, the comments that we hear from people, when there is a recognition of their affective states, it is the same thing. It's sad. I'm frustrated. I'm confused. Or when anger is invoked, it's invoked in sense of the past. We were angry then. So here, and this is sort of how I'll wrap this up. So for us, the question arises, in the American context, we do anger very well, right? We're injured, we have a collective sense of wound, a collective sense of injury, we get pissed off, we march in the streets, right? Social movements begin this way. Social movements begin with the electricity of anger, fury, rage. Eventually, the initial sort of catastrophe, the initial sort of damage, the initial injustice is addressed, then what? And this is the second phase of all social movements in America. In feminism, migrant struggles, civil rights movements, so forth. What effective state will sustain us? I think that this question is a question of aesthetics. I think that this is where organizing engages the aesthetic. How do we invoke people's feelings and their affects? How do we collectively wrestle those feelings into words? And how do those words become an analysis? And how does that analysis produce an action? I think we're real good at dealing with pissed off. I think we're not so good at dealing with melancholia. And you will hear from many people, melancholia is the anathema of activism. Grief is the anathema of organizing. In ACT UP, there were essays written on this. People were thrown out of the group because they dared to take the floor and talk about their depression. Go see a shrink, they were told. Well, we're all there now. I think for us as artists, whether we're sound artists, whether we're visual artists, whether we're theater people, dance people, I think this is where we are so fucking needed. And not needed because the organizers don't get aesthetics, but because there's not much support for it. Because there's not much time for it. So how can we develop projects that take the time? Okay, I'll stop there. We have 20 minutes before lunch. Is that right, Carl? What I'd like to do is, you've heard the four of us in our presentations. You've heard Eddie's sound pieces. I'd like to sort of open up to initial comments, questions that we can respond to quickly in this place. We will take lunch and then we will come back and the conversation will move through the room.